This is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is guest co-host Darcy Ross.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Darcy Talk About Stuff.
Known for the rest of the year, little known, as Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Live from Gen Con, the best 4 days in gaming.
Coming to you once more from Indianapolis, home of such haunted locations as...
The Central State Hospital.
The James Allison Mansion.
And the Slippery Noodle Restaurant.
We're not kidding. Look it up.
Depending on what you ask us, stuff we might talk about in this episode include...
Tabletop and adventure gaming.
Snails.
Tradecraft.
Nudibranches.
Occultism.
Polykeets.
And of course... food.
Whoa, is that a new Ars Magica?
Not just new, it's the definitive edition. 20 years in the making, it's a love letter to our favorite game.
It's kind of thick, isn't it? 580 pages. Did they include every rule from every Ars Magica book ever?
Almost. It's still the fifth edition, but powered up with 20 years of awesomeness.
Can I still use my favorite Magus, the one who saved Mythic Europe from that infernal plot?
Of course. Your characters, your stories, they're all welcome here. Think of it as a grand reunion, a homecoming for the wizards we once were.
Oh, this new art is gorgeous, and the layout, it's the edition that Ars Magica always deserved. I'm ready! Ready to delve back into Mythic Europe! To see what new wonders await, ready to weave great magics once more.
Then let us begin our new saga, my friend. Ars Magica Definitive Edition is at our friendly local game store now, or go to atlas-games.com/definitive to order online. Then the stories we'll tell will echo through the ages. Welcome once more to Ken and Darcy Talk About Stuff here in the intimate, acoustically perfect confines of the Haymarket Room in the Crown Plaza. As always, this could not happen without the Patreon backers, our beloved Patreon backers, and where we normally shout them out individually in the show. Today, if they lurk amongst you unseen, stand and receive your approbation. Give the people your love. Give them all the clapping.
Thank you.
All the love. Without these people and people similar to them, we would not have a podcast, and we would all be sadder for it. Also, because this is a live episode and being recorded, and it's being recorded on space-age technology such as my phone, that means that I will have to repeat the question, or sometimes Darcy will have to repeat the question. So sometimes you will ask a question, and in the spirit of timing and comedy, we will launch into an answer. And when we do that, what we need you to do is shout back, repeat the question. So let's practice. Someone ask Darcy a question that gives her a chance to unleash her laser-like riposte. Any question.
Darcy, what's the best thing about snails?
Why, I'm so glad you asked. Let's talk about genes.
There we go. A little more, you know, focused up, but, you know, that's why we have rehearsals.
Yeah.
Anyway, as always, Robin is mortified that he cannot be here, but he is Canadian. He's not mortified about that. That's just, there's a logical connection there. And I believe, however, Robin is here amongst us in spirit. He has sent his ectoplasmic essence into this room, possibly via my phone, possibly via other shared cellular connections that we may or may not have. And while in spirit form, he is carrying with him his focus object, his fetter, as we call it, the Nerd Trope deck created by beloved listener Caliph Tate. Accept no substitutes. Now, Darcy, Robin, I believe, will speak to you through the medium of the ether, and you will summon up the Nerd Trope question. And I want to clarify, there is no trickery here. Darcy and I have never met. We are total strangers. I mean, come on.
I think I can feel Robin calling out to me. The nerd card is the 9 Years' War.
The 9 Years' War.
The trope card is yokai.
Yokai. Well, 9 Years' War. Goodness me. Darcy, would you mind just just to clarify a couple of things. Would you mind making sure that the 9 years were still called that in Wikipedia?
It's very important to double check.
Oh, that 9 years war.
There
all right.
We go, there we go.
Okay. That is also known as the War of the Grand Alliance. It is the war between Louis XIV and literally everyone else in Europe, mostly Holland and Great Britain, because the Dutch cleverly put their own king on the throne of Great Britain as part of their always have a stronger friend policy. Other opponents of King Louis included at various times Spain, Austria, Prussia, and various Italian states that don't need to concern us right now. And the question was yokai. Yokai, of course, are the, what do I want to say? Mischievous is too light, evil is too strong. Their closest analogy is the fairy population, real legendary fairy, not Victorian or Shakespeare fairy population of Europe. The yokai are from Japan. So, question is, what is going on in Japan at the near the turn of the 17th century, the turn of the 18th century, 17th into 8th, 1698 is when the war ends. So the situation in Japan at this time is that the Tokugawa shoguns have clamped down over the last of the resistance to their rule. They began conquering Japan in the 1580s, 1590s. They drove out most of the Christians and put down the Christian rebellions in the 1610s and 30s. Then they put down the last of the individual daimyo rebellions and basically penned up the emperor. So by the beginning of the 9 Years' War, the Tokugawa had been ruling Japan with, one hesitates to say an iron fist, but let us say a mailed fist. It could have been that lovely lacquer that they had for several generations. And the result is that if you are spirits that delight in chaos and someone is clamping down on order, you don't have a lot of places to go. But fortunately for the yokai, the Dutch at this time have a trading post in Nagasaki, inoffensive seaport town of Nagasaki, which would never again appear in history. So the yokai flowed to the Dutch trading post in Nagasaki as the only place that the writ of the shogun did not travel. I mean, it still did, but they, being Dutch, they understood that a certain amount of chaos is necessary for markets to function. And the Dutch, as we all know, are not just Protestants, but Calvinist Protestants, which is to say the branch of Protestantism that theologically determined that time is money. So the Dutch are perhaps welcoming the yokai with some reservations initially, but when the yokai said, we just want to pay passage on your ships to get out of Japan because it is clamping down on our chaotic vibe and we don't like that. And the Dutch said, you said pay for passage. And the yokai said, yes, we did. And since they're not European fairies, when they pay you gold or silver or the ability to speak the tongues of the wrens, it doesn't turn into leaves the next day. So the Dutch are like, great, your check cleared, let's go. So the yokai begin flowing, first of all, to many of the Dutch colonies in East Asia, but eventually they all came back to the main Dutch homeland. So by the beginnings of the war, there's a fairly sizable immigrant population of yokai in the Netherlands. And again, after 1688, the Glorious Revolution, they begin going into England. Now, the trouble with this is that there's already fairies in England. I think I mentioned them. These fairies, worse yet, are very old school. They are reactionary. They do not believe in the Glorious Revolution of William of Orange. They believe in the Stuarts. They want to go back to the old days. In fact, they want to go back to the Catholic days, but the Stuarts are the next best thing. So the elves and such are all Jacobins. They are, or Jacobites, excuse me. They're not Jacobins. That's the other thing. They're all Jacobites. They want the return of the Stuarts, Bonnie Prince Charlie, all that good yuck. This, in this case, is good King James, and then James is James the Lesser, his son. Bonnie Prince Charlie's the grandson. Anyway, so we got good King James, the king over the water, and we've got a bunch of fae who are mad at this yokai immigrant flux. And so they say, well, England is at war. Let's take advantage of this opportunity to bring back the king over the water and return him to the throne with fae backing. And that will give us the power behind the throne that we haven't had since the good days of Queen Elizabeth Gloriana of sainted memory. So we are set up with, I hope you're paying attention, three different possible campaigns. We have yokai fighting against Louis the 14th for fun and money. Louis the 14th, the closest thing to a shogun Europe is producing, in that he is devoted to order. You can look at the gardens at Versailles, you can look at the palace, you can look at the whole Sun King Vauban architecture. He's just drawing lines and having architects come out and do stuff. Yokai don't like that. Yokai like the old wild ways. They like the Romanesque architecture. They like crazy nonsense. They like, basically, they like the things that the Dutch are doing, which is to say, lots of color, lots of art, lots of fruit in the paintings. They love that stuff. So the yokai are fighting for the Dutch against the French. That's one campaign. Campaign two, you have your elves and fae acting as a resistance against William of Orange, William and Mary, and then bringing into power the King of the Water. So we have a burbling revolution game that could break out into revolution if that's what you want to do. And then you also, of course, have the war between the yokai and the fae in England. So you say, Peg Peller's had something coming to her. Oh, look, it's a kappa. He's going to pour stuff out of his head right on her. That's going to annoy everyone. And go on from there. And so you can take the craziest of your yokais, the ones with the floating heads, the ones with the stretchy necks, the ones that are giant clocks that walk around, the spiders that are made out of wristwatches, all of those guys show up and start messing with the old school fae. And the old school fae, they have certain, you know, constraints, iron, etc., etc., yokai just don't seem to have. Yokai, what they fear is Shinto exorcists. Not a lot of those in England. So if you are an underdog type person, maybe you are going with the fae. If you are a, I want to play that wristwatch made of spiders, or vice versa, maybe you're a yokai type person. We have a great fantasy fairy war that is happening back and forth across England. Maybe you play the innocent citizens of Manchester or whoever are like, what the hell is going on? But we do have a lot of orders for wristwatches, so maybe we should just keep this up. Or, of course, any number of Dutch pirates, Spanish cavaliers, or anything else that strikes your fancy in the tag end of the 17th century. I think D'Artagnan is historically dead by now, but I'm not going to make you change it if you decide D'Artagnan is alive. Or maybe D'Artagnan got his life extended by one of the white women of Brittany and is there because he's wielding a sword so fine that it can even stab a yokai. Who can say? All I can say is that you got three musketeers, a spider made of wristwatches, the king over the water. What the heck more do you need?
Perpend, my friend, while admiring your perspicacity, I could sense in you the instincts of a fellow bargain hunter.
What rude blackguard interrupts me as I sip and sup?
Your characterization is jejune. I am but a humble traveler here with tidings of a humble bundle.
Spite myself, my ears perk, for those words portend RPG savings.
Not just savings, but a rare opportunity to bask in the PDF treasures of the game that started Pelgrane Press.
And you mean the Dying Earth role-playing game, based on the immortal fantasy works of Jack Vance?
And designed by a scoundrel known as Robin D. Laws, but speak no more of him.
I shall not, but I have heard rumors of this game, its fantastic wonders, its articulate and ravenous creatures, its cut and thrust of verbal one-upmanship.
Not mere rumors, but bedrock truths.
With my scrying device, I now go to humblebundle.com and search for the Dying Earth RPG collection.
Together, let us behold these wonders. For a mere $5, receive the fully explanatory quick start rules, plus the Turgeon's Tome Dark Fantasy Sourcebook, and the first issue of the Dying Earth zine, Prismatic Spray.
As a gamer of superior discernment, I might prefer to spend $10 and also receive Kugel's Compendium, the book for rapscallion-level play.
Surely, though, you wish to show your vast superiority by getting everything for $18. The core rules, its rules upgrade, the revivification folio.
I see it before me. Also, the Archmagician-level sourcebook, the city book, the world book, everything! Everything!
But as the sickly sun will soon extinguish itself above our weary heads, not even bundle deals last forever. This one concludes on the 11th of September at 11 a.m. Pacific.
I'll never remember that. I must secure this bargain now.
Then do so by searching immediately for the Dying Earth RPG Collection at humblebundle.com.
Now, Darcy, I have a question for you. This is not a nerd trope because I don't have the deck. You can see that there's no deck in front of me at any time. My sleeves are clean. But as you know, during the 4th century BC, the Antigonid occupiers of Athens designed a war snail. This was a snail-shaped chariot. This is for real, that they would use to go through the narrow streets of Athens to prevent people from dropping paving stones on their heads. And they would deploy their special ops when they were trying to grab democratic agitators off the street. It was very now-coded. And so the war snail apparently disappeared in history. But Darcy, what you're going to reveal, possibly for the first time ever, is either what happened to the war snails, where did they go, what was their role, or what other mollusks, crustaceans, or sea creatures, gastropods of any kind, really, did the Macedonians also build?
Now, the war snail, of course, was, I assume, made of metal.
Yeah.
So
wood frame metal cladding.
Of course, of course. So the interesting thing here is that they were not the inventors of the war snail.
I am shocked to learn that.
Yes, I know. I know. This, you're hearing it here first. So like many good biological organisms, we make some hard substances. We make calcium, we in our bones, right? We make hard bony parts, but we're mostly fleshy bits with some little hard parts. One of the interesting innovations of gastropods, certainly of the scaly foot gastropod, found deep, deep, deep underneath the ocean by the sea vents, hydrothermal sea vents, is that we have found that with sheets of iron on top of its scales, on top of its foot, not even the shell, right? So this thing can bring in and precipitate iron metal onto its body. Now, this is what I propose the Athenians had brought up, figured out some way to have it not explode from the pressure change, and had...
Well, as we all know, Alexander the Great did invent the diving bell.
There we go.
Brought the iron foot snail up from the deeps and gave it to his loyal regent Antipater, and it passed on to the Macedonian army from there.
This is my theory. But what I don't know is how the scaly foot gastropod is about this big. So how did they, in that day and age, get it to be so enormous that it could shield whole soldiers from those falling pavement stones? That's the currently unsolved part of this mystery.
Now, obviously, there's two theories of this. There's my theory, which is Poseidon did it. And what would your theory be, Darcy, as to how they grew those iron foot snails to war machine sizes?
That's such a great question. I think it was by sort of sped up, like, breeding under very strange conditions, because invertebrates, one of the benefits of them is that they create lots and lots of eggs. You can really get a lot of replication in your scientific experiments. So I think it could be done through highly specialized breeding practices.
Well, if you're looking for breeding under strange circumstances, there is no better place to look than classical Greece. And with that, we open the floor to your well-thought, incisive, and welcome questions. Please begin. The best food that I've had this week. Oh, thank you. Well done, everybody. The question is, what is the best food that I've had this week, despite it being Saturday and me being slammed? Well, first of all, I have to tell you that last year I discovered the duck wings at the Whistle Stop Inn, which is right near the convention and is never crowded. It's still that, but the duck wings are off the menu. So, yes, I was as heartbroken as you. Otherwise, I would have had a slam dunk answer to that question. The best food that I've had so far at the show is the lamb empanadas at, what's the name of the restaurant? It's not Linear. If you search empanada restaurant Indianapolis, you will almost certainly come up with it. But it is the restaurant that I went to with my beloved publisher, Al Mangold, on Thursday. They had the lamb empanadas that had a poblano crema with it, which you, oh my God, just, you know, pour it into my orifices. It's so good. Darcy, do you have a food triumph?
I do, but I don't know that it's something you can go get yourself, which I regret to tease you with this. But I think part of the best food when you're working a con is the food that is brought to you lovingly by your work wife in the morning before you've woken up. Elise Resendez, senior RPG producer of Daggerheart, is my neighbor, and I've been working very, very hard on the con so far, and I've been waking up each morning and she has a latte and a little breakfast sandwich for me, and I think there is absolutely nothing better.
Yep. Love is the best ingredient. Garlic is only second. This is known. Yes. The question concerns Nodens. What is his unique status within the Lovecraft mythos, and what is the relationship with the other deities? Nodens appears twice. He appears in Strange High House in the Mist, where he is one of the signs that the house on the clifftop at Kingsport abuts on a other and possibly parasitic dimension. Nodens appears with the god Neptune, who somehow does not make it into the rest of the mythos. But there he is, a hoary Nodens. He shows up, and then he is also in Dream Quest of Unknown Kadeth, placed as an opponent of Nyarlathotep, and he has with him some Nightgaunts, and the Nightgaunts serve him. And so the general approach is that if he's against Nyarlathotep, he must be our guy. August Derleth decided this before World War II, so he didn't know that you could be against the guy we're against and still not remotely be our guy. But that is the general way that he has been treated as a, if not beneficent god, at least not an actively hostile or even neutrally hostile god. Now, I will say that exposure to Nodens in Strange High House tends to leech the light out of Frank Olney's eyes, the guy that is the narrator of that story. So I would still handle with care. Fun facts about Nodens also, just to throw this in, beloved philologist J.R.R. Tolkien is the guy who wrote the scientific paper, scientific, philology is not a science, the philological paper demonstrating that Nodens, the Romano-British god of Lydney Park in Shropshire or Herefordshire, whichever it is, was also the same as Nuadha of the Silverhand, the god of the Irish. And so if you have lots and lots and lots of myths about Nuadha Argatlam and no myths about Nodens, well, there you go. We've drilled a hole in the wall. So you can take any of Nuadha's myths and apply them and mythosify them as you wish. Again, Nuadha's a pretty good god, as Irish gods go, but even he is a bit problematic. So I would... Tolkien made that connection. Yeah. Another question.
The question is, what makes a great con scenario? Which is such a great question. Yeah, I think that I have run an awful lot of con scenarios. I think modularity is great in any adventure, a little bit of flexibility. One of the great joys of a con game is that you don't know who you're getting. You know, everybody's coming from different experiences and different levels of familiarity with the game. They don't know each other, and I think that can be really part of the magic. But I think what can be challenging sometimes is if the con adventure is a little too rigid and you kind of can't tune it as best to your players. I think part of what I'm always doing as a GM is just watching the lights go up in people's eyes. Like, you can see them perk up and you can see them perk down, and there's plenty you can do that doesn't have to be in the scenario to address that. But I think a little bit of here are the scenes that I need to go through, like making sure the GM really understands what are the key immutable aspects of this con adventure, and so that I can skip over things if we need to change pacing. Maybe not a great con adventure piece, but I think a good con adventure should have a natural point for a break for everyone to go get a water, and then they come back really perked up. So I think if you can have kind of an exciting climax sort of in the middle and let people go. So yeah, I think like modularity, clarity about what pieces you need to hit so you can skip what you don't hit and you can really vibe with what they're reacting to. And then just like having really playtested the pacing on that, so you have a cool moment right at break, get people excited, get them water so that they don't lose steam by the end. Especially I'm thinking for a 4-hour game.
I would agree with everything Darcy said. I mean, generically also, but in this case, exactly. The key thing that I would say also is to keep your adventure to a 2-act model.
Yeah.
Don't try for a 3-act model. If you have a 3-act model, begin at the turn from act 1 to act 2.
Mm-hmm.
Begin in medias res, because almost always in a scenario, if it's good, players want to engage with and they want to bite down and they want to chew scenery. So you don't have the time that you might think you do.
Mm-hmm.
So ideally, the first act sets it up, it gets everyone into trouble, and the second act is just rising action until everyone is dead or victorious. I've talked before about the roller coaster theory of horror. You can apply that. You begin halfway down the track, not at the top of the track, if you can do that at all. That's my advice. And next question. The question is, what systems or system do you primarily run? And when he said that, he was looking at Darcy. So, Darcy.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So I have run, and I sort of cut my teeth on GMing at con games with the Cypher system, with Numenera. That's just sort of what got me all started. And I think that's a very great, great con system. I think folks can jump into it pretty easily, even if they're newer to the RPGs, but there's a lot of depth and flexibility that folks who have played a bunch still find it very comfortable. And they have a lot of experienced writers of con scenarios, so I definitely had a lot of fun there. I would say also, though, that just thinking of our mutual friend John Harness, stuff we've busted out at cons, even small community-based cons. Like, I love something that you can just pull out of a pocket and just start playing, right? I think one of the, you know, there's scheduled con games, but of course, part of the specialness of any of these places is that there's gamers everywhere. You throw a stick and you've hit a gamer. So something that you can kind of unveil when you find a critical mass of folks who want to sit down and play. So I think something that John often would bring out is like Fate Accelerated or basically any game that you know like the back of your hand. So Cypher I've done a lot. Daggerheart is what my current company has been making, so I could definitely run that on a dime. Oh, and you know what I also love? There's so many great like one page or couple zine like indie games that I've gone back to for cons. Lasers and Feelings is sort of a deep pull from the past, but it's a one page RPG. You throw it on the table, you're randomizing some elements about the sort of space scenario that you're in, and you're going, right? I think like whatever can lower the friction to getting into right into that media res, right? is what's best. So I've played around with a number of those. How about yourself?
My vast majority of con games have been Call of Cthulhu because I used to do demos for Chaosium back in the day. And I have also run a good number of Gumshoe games by now at cons. And I find that the speed with which Gumshoe can allow you to proceed through the story is a really good thing for a con scenario. Yeah. You can run, obviously, Hero in cons. People who are good at Hero can do that. I'm not saying don't use a complex system. Just be as knowledgeable about it as Darren Watts is, and then, or was, God bless him, and then you can run whatever you want to do. It's really about the structure of the story, not about the structure of the game. Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Another question. Octopi get all the love from horror scenarios. What are some other mollusks or similar creatures that you would use to terrify someone in, say, a Fall of Delta Green scenario? And before Darcy answers, I would like to give Darcy's answer when I asked her that very question when I was writing Operation Alonzo for Borealis Connection. The characters are going through the old tunnels that used to be the canals of Saigon. Now, in boring history, the canals were filled in, but in fun mythos history, they were just covered over. And so there's water-filled tunnels underneath virtually all of old Saigon. And the player characters have to go down into it. And I asked Darcy, what is the worst thing that they could meet in those tunnels? And without batting an eye, she said, catenophores. And I said, why catenophores? And she says, they turn inside out and gloop you up. And I said, repeat that. And she said, I will do worse. And she showed me a YouTube video of a Catena 4 turning inside out and glooping something up. And I said, enormous Catena 4 stats. That was years ago. Darcy surely knows even more evil sea creatures, so please share.
Gosh, where to start? But I have to say, a favorite of mine is a Chaetopterus. I don't know if you could see too well, but they are tube worms. They are burrowing. They create tubes in sandy sediment, and they just have so many eldritch segments, and they don't look like... You know, they are just so horrible.
That is a Lee Bart Brown Coy cover illustration if ever I saw it.
Mm-hmm. And they've just got horrible mouth parts. I think polychaetes as a whole are really spectacular, but tube worms are like naked, horrible innards because they secrete this tube, right, that they're making, and they live in it. But you can use basically any kind of translucent or transparent, like, plastic tube for them to go in instead and sort of save them the trouble. And then you get to see all of their horrible parts sort of moving water through and sort of paddling it through with all these spines. I think those...
Everyone who was listening at home was like, okay, I can handle it. And then she says, all of the spines. Hey. Yeah, not good.
Yeah, I would say they like to sneak up on you when you're in a microscope looking for tiny little snail larvae, you know, innocent snail larvae, and then you see this huge, like, sort of like a Star Wars giant ship, right, coming across the vision is this horrible polychaete, you know, 100 times the size of what you're looking for.
I don't like any of that.
Chaetopterus.
All right, well, no one is going to top Chaetopterus today, so what is the next question? What is it that I find interesting about Aleister Crowley, or is there fun trivia that we can all enjoy? Darcy, you're sort of, I don't want to say the normie, but compared to me, you're the normie on Aleister Crowley. Is there something about him that you find interesting at all, or are you just like evil sorcerer, what's not to love?
Evil sorcerer, what's not to love? I'm trying to remember. I know he's come up because I know I have heard some of your fun facts, but I don't know that enough of them have stuck, so I'm going to have to pass it back to you.
All right. The thing that fascinates me about Crowley, and I think fascinates a lot of people, is that he was really a very good writer. And so you read his autohagiography, and you can't not laugh at that joke. You read Magic and Theory and Practice, which is in no wise a 101 manual, but is meant to annoy and terrify. You read his letters. He's just a fun, clever, good writer. His mystery stories starring Simon If, which is one of his, you know, sort of Mary Sue character inserts. And Simon If will go around and solve crimes by saying no one who wore that tie could possibly have the moral force to commit murder. He's just endlessly delightful as a writer. But he is also a horrendous human being. He just was horribly vile to every woman he ever was with. And it is a long list. He basically would, well... I don't know that we can, you know, say exactly what he did in the desert with New Birth, but it was unconsensual by the end of it. And whether that was because the demon Karanzan was involved or not, I can't say. My favorite fun fact is that he used to be part of a sex magic throuple with New York Times correspondent Walter Duranty, the man who denied the Stalin of Famine, the Holodomor denier. Walter Duranty still has the Pulitzer. They haven't taken it away from him, that he won for saying no famine here. But he also was in a sex magic throuple with Aleister Crowley. And that shows you that if you work very hard, you can do worse things than be in a sex magic throuple with Aleister Crowley. Next question. All the Walter Duranty stands are like, I'm not taking part in this.
Let's get away from him. Any new drink discoveries?
Any new drink discoveries is the question. Well, I don't know that it's new. I don't know how new it is, but I was at Luffmiller's last night, and the poor staff at these bars, they all change the names of their drinks to dumb nerd names. And the bar staff are decent human beings who have jobs and lives. They can't be paying attention to this nonsense. And so when you say, I'd like the Paladin, please, you get a deserved go-away insect stare from the waitress. But it turns out the Paladin is amazing. It's Jameson's whiskey, ginger beer, and cider. So you're like, oh, this is a Boilermaker, but now you've added ginger beer to it. And you've made it with Jameson's for extra fight and fun. So Yeah. I mean, it's a Boilermaker with ginger beer. I say it out loud, and everyone's like, well, why didn't you think of that? And it's like, because someone had to invent the buffalo wing. Things don't just... Boilermaker, yeah, is a beer that you put a shot into. Stone Fence is a cider that you put a shot into. Yeah, it's a good walk away. But that is the drink discovery that I've made at this show. Darcy, you are a dedicated imbiber. What have you imbibed that is delightful to you?
Yeah, the new discovery for me, and I'm sure it's not new to other folks here, but is Black Manhattans. So you've got rye and various Amaro, basically like a Verna Amaro, but there's so many Amaros out there that you can really play with. When it's a very tasty cocktail to start with, but then you have so many variations that you can play with. I think the Black Manhattan is just going to keep on giving, especially with playing with different bitters. So I think it's just fun to discover something that's a very simple, you know, traditional like cocktail, but then you have a whole diversity of experimentation that you can do within that simple cocktail. I'm sort of a big fan. That's also an Elise Resendez special. She got me hooked on them.
Like they used to say, there are 3 million stories in the Naked City of the original Manhattan, and I guess there are 3 million Black Manhattans that you can make.
Yep. The Fountain Club is a little off the beaten path here, but they have spectacular old fashions and Manhattans, and they've got really nice selections. So if you're looking for one of those, I had a great, great rye old fashioned over there, and it was spectacular.
Is there any reason that she is slotting into Robin's slot on this show? I ask you, the witnesses, the audience. Yes, in the back. The question is, what are our top three movies of the year so far? I've been slow to watch a bunch of movies. There's stuff that I'm, you know, waiting for streaming or whatever I didn't catch. So far, I would say Odyssey is number one. It's the new Nolan, so yes, canon is a Christopher Nolan aficionado. Get over it. Let's see, what else have I given the big nod to? I'm trying to think if I've seen any sort of grown-up movies that I would put in that list. The grown-up movies, they usually release late. I will say that right now, although I very much liked Backrooms, I don't think it's in my top three, but it is what is coming to mind, which I guess argues that maybe it is in my top three, because the visuals are striking, and that is half of a movie at least. And then let's see, what else have I seen that is new this year? Oh, The Furious, obviously. Screw you, The Backrooms. Furious is still in my top three, and that is honestly in my top three, and that may be in my top 10. That is the martial arts film by, I want to say Takagihara. I'm almost certainly wrong about that, but it's a action director. He's a fight choreographer, basically, and this is his first feature, and he then hired a different fight choreographer to do the fighting for it. Because as he said, I know how hard it is to fight choreograph. I can't do that and direct. So in the same way that Nolan, I knew we'd come back to Nolan, works very, very closely with his composer to make the music, you know, narrows down instruments and gives tones and beats and things like that. In the same way, the director did the same thing with his fight choreographer to build fight choreography of a nature and a sort that you literally have not seen in movies. They developed a new way to kick a guy in the head. Mind blowing. Crazily good movie, almost nonstop action. Five-sided fight at the end that is just sock off blowing. It's almost as good as The Raid. And if you've seen The Raid, you know how good that is. And of course, it has Joe Taslim from The Raid. So lots of great continuity in that. Magnificent film. Saw it in Omaha, Nebraska. Never has there been a greater contrast between the movie and where I saw the movie. So good. Darce, what are your three?
This is not going to make me look good. I'm just warning you all.
As long as you say The Odyssey, all will be forgiven.
Yeah. Since I have moved away from Chicago, my film education has sort of gone down in quality, but...
Let's say cratered.
So the three most recent movies I've watched, and I haven't watched a lot this year because it's early yet. I guess it's all halfway through. But the three most recent that I've watched, and the one respectable movie I've watched is Project Hail Mary. I'm a scientist at heart. All we ever want to do is meet alien life, okay? It's great.
Just ignore the centrifuge and you'll be good.
I was so mad about that centrifuge. Everyone, I think, nails on chalkboard for every scientist. But when
repeat the heckle.
Everyone's mad about the centrifuge. Ignore right. the centrifuge right. and it's a perfect movie. But what I've been introduced to by my other pals, because I'm away from Ken, is basically like 90s and early aughts movies I missed. I've missed a lot of movies. So I've recently watched 10 Things I Hate About You, which was awesome, super fun, great. Deb's queer as all get out, very shockingly just funky, just a funky, weird.
It is
weird
arguably movie. The greatest lesbian spy musical ever made.
It was awesome. And then I also saw She's the Man.
Oh!
Which is...
When you come back to Chicago, uh-huh, you've got to see the Bollywood version of that, which kicks.
Okay, great. So I'm on a very strange movie journey. Clearly, as we leave, you should all give me your best movie recommendations, because yes. I need some extra.
I will just say towards that there has never been a less convincing disguise as a man than that performed by Ronnie Mukherjee in that movie. Oh. It's insane. All right. On a Ronnie Mukherjee note.
Can I just ask a brief follow-up? Did you see the IMAX? Did you see Odyssey in IMAX? Or did you see
the follow-up is, did I see the Odyssey in IMAX? Chicago recently got an IMAX back. We only had LIMAX. We now have a 70mm IMAX screen in the South Loop. And yes, I did. I, in fact, took my lovely wife, Sheila, to it for our anniversary. Because that's how you anniversary, and that's how you stay married for 32 years. The British are coming.
The Kickstarter campaign is almost upon us for Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
The Kickstarter campaign also features a revised core book supporting play in other eras, a supplement about political scheming within the two sides of the war, and years of maps, supplements, splat books, and adventures following the war from Boston to Yorktown.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
This Kickstarter is the best time ever to get into Nations and Cannons.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com.
Another question, possibly about Sheila, possibly about something else. Yes. In the creation and testing of a tabletop system, what is one element that we considered or that we did not initially consider, and how did we address that element? Darce, do you want to take that from the ones you've been a fly on the wall for? I think you've co-created one system, so you can even talk about Burn Bright if you wanted to.
I could. I think something that comes to mind, just because it's more recent, is so Daggerheart had a big open beta playtesting phase that I was pretty involved in sort of disseminating, and we were doing a lot of internal playtesting. So let's see. One of the things that we really... So basically, one of the key elements of Daggerheart is that what it has turned into is a truly like initiative-less system. So the way that you get back and forth between the players and the rest of the world, right, is this spotlight system. And so I think something that we... Something we played... I think an interesting point to get what you're at is like... We did a ton of playtesting. We really had to tweak a lot of things balance-wise to make sure it was flowing in a way that, like, you know, didn't get too lopsided. But one of the things that I think was intriguing is that we had basically an optional rule that was like, if you just want initiative, like, here's how that works, little tokens and stuff. What we ended up doing is removing that. We have a very, very minor, like, if you're playing with a group of players who just really need that structure, here's how to do it. But I think I think it was interesting that the final design choice really like made a decision. I think one thing that's tough when you're playtesting is there are many good options sometimes. And I think it is really valuable to kind of commit, even though you know that there are multiple pretty right paths. I think that's one of the like heartbreaks of making a game is you have to make the one game. And I think the other thing that's tricky is often the designers are the ones who have all those alternate history games in their heads. And so they're often struggling to teach the final version of the game because you know all the different branching paths that they could be. So I think that was just a really good example of like, we could provide many, many options for folks to play variants of this game, but we really need to, we found what was special about it even though some people will want to modify it, we need to like go all in. We need to provide support for this style of play, you know, give a little section to the alternate way of doing it. But like, I think you just really have to make strong choices sometimes and like commit to it and give a lot of support for that choice, even when you know that there are other good choices to be made. And I think that's the fun difficulty of it.
I will say that by and large, I've made very few games from scratch. Mm. And when I did, I was usually collaborating. So when we did the Star Trek game for Last Unicorn, we did it from scratch. And then when we did Star Trek game all over again for Decipher, we did it from scratch. But at no point did we look at the game and go, ah, we forgot Starship Combat. The second time we did Starship Combat, we got in a giant brouhaha between the team that liked how Starship Combat had worked in Icon and wanted to just port it, and the team that hated how Starship Combat worked in Icon and did not want to just port it. And I think we settled that with a series of Starship battles played out in the various rules. Like, okay, you think you're so smart, Enterprise versus D9, let's go. And that sort of taught us a lot about our own system, first of all, because doing dedicated iterative testing is something that sometimes you don't have time to do, given the tight deadlines we were under on both those projects. I can also give an example that when I was doing Bubble Gumshoe with the sainted Emily Carabas and the great Lisa Steele, I was the Gumshoe guy, so my job was to sort of adapt the Gumshoe part to it. And I get the rules back and I'm going through it, and I realize that unlike in standard Gumshoe, you need to be able to push your way past someone. In Gumshoe, normally you're just getting, you know, a clue out of the person, but often the person is like a lock to a door. They're an obstacle to the nightclub, and you have to get past them somehow. And I needed a way to do that, and there is no way in conventional Gumshoe to do it. Because if you just spend a point every time, it becomes, you know, too easy. Yeah. So I created interpersonal ability, not combat, but opposition, as a new sub-Gumshoe rule that is only relevant to Veronica Mars and games that resemble Veronica Mars. But I didn't even think about it because it's not in core Gumshoe. And then I realized, oh, for this episode to work ever, you have to be able to do this. And a similar thing happened in Nice Black Agents, which was not quite as dramatic. But I remember being at the home of beloved game publisher and designer John Zinsser with a ton of game designers. And we were watching one of the Lord of the Rings movies, I forget which one, but every time any of the characters did a thing, Ryan Dancy, who had been intimately involved in third edition development, would call out the name of the feat they were using. Which, I mean, we'd all seen the movies 900 times, so it wasn't annoying, it was hilarious. And so, as I'm watching the Bourne trilogy for the number here time and trying to see how do I do that in Knight's Black Agents, which I'm designing in the process, I noticed he keeps disarming people. He just will like reach in and take their gun away type stuff. And we didn't really have a dedicated system in Gumshoe for that. So I had to write the disarm mechanic both for you have nothing, they have a weapon, how do you do it? Cool. You have a weapon, they have a weapon, how do you do it? They have a weapon ready, you have nothing, how do you do it? So it, because, again, normally, you can't disarm someone who's got a gun out. They will kill you. But if you're Jason Bourne, ha-ha, yes, you can. And then I looked into it, and it turns out that if you're special forces, you were trained to sort of close the distance, or like hardcore FBI hostage team guys, you're trained to close the distance, and then psychologically it becomes uncomfortable. The guy stops being mission-focused and killing you, and then you can get in under his operations loop if you're good and get the gun away. If you're bad, you will be killed, which is, I guess, why they have to train special people for it. But I knew I needed a mechanic. I came with a mechanic. I did the research to see how they do the mechanic in real life, if they do, and it turns out they do. And so that was sort of the iterative process of putting disarm into Knight's Black Agents. So that's the example there.
Thank you.
Do we have another question? Everyone wants to know why I'm on a watch list. This is the question. What do I know has put me most on a watch list? And by now, that's a long list. Was it when I downloaded the CIA torture manual? No, I might have been working for the New Republic. Was it when I downloaded the Al-Qaeda how to deploy ricin manual? No, I could have been working for the Jacobin. Was it when I downloaded or did a great deal of searching on Vladimir Putin personal security? Who can say? But what I have found out is from a friend of mine who, as he puts it, works in Maryland. And I unveiled myself of this same concern that perhaps my pattern of Google searches was creating something of a enormous red flag, a Xi Jinping parade-sized red flag, perhaps, in my file. And he said, oh, Ken, you don't have to worry. Everyone at Fort Meade, because if you're one of those assholes, you never, it's like being at Harvard. No one at Fort Meade is getting you in trouble. And I said, why not? And he said, because they're all nerds. Everyone there in the agency is recruited because they are gigantic math nerds. That's how you get to that job. So what happens to your file is they fight over it, and one of them who gets it is running your game 6 months before it's released. That is what's happening to your file. Darcy, do you have a file?
My file is coming more from the science side.
And note associate of my file, I guess.
Yeah. Unfortunately, something that's really interesting about science is that different techniques and like reagents are sort of gained and lost over time for various reasons. So if you want to, say, you know, inject something into a little snail larvae, okay, you need it to stop wiggling and you want it to stay alive. So the question is how to anesthetize like little invertebrates, right? And when I went around various like marine biological labs and stuff, I was really having trouble with some of the like standard salts and stuff you put them in. They were wiggling through that just fine. And all the old timers who were there and who had been there since forever, they were like, well, you know what you need to use, of course. Cocaine. They were like, it's the only thing that reliably works. It's sort of cocaine and what else was it? Oh, there were some other gnarly, like definitely putting you on a watch list that I wouldn't even mention, drugs that they were like, those are the ones you want. And they were sort of like, we have like a shady vial back in the dark corner, right? But I was like, I can't replicate that. I can't say in my paper,
you
take 1 milliliter of the shady vial in the back corner from a bunch of potheads in the 70s who were like, had it stored away. So unfortunately, I'm looking up like cocaine alternatives, really similar to cocaine. Can I get it from another country? So unfortunately, and I never quite got it. They were always wiggling. I never found a good enough alternative.
So if you have a snail larva Rohypnol, you can write your own ticket.
That was one of them. Yep.
Can I get it from another country? All right. Well, I'm glad that you have your own file.
Yep.
Yes. The question is, after you use the cocaine, when do you get back to the snails?
Exactly. Yeah. I just for fun fact, the idea behind the snails, of course, is that they have mathematically regular shells. So they are a shape that you have plenty of organic diversity, tons of species of snails. So you've got a shape that has lots and lots of variation, and it has a fossil record. So you have so much deep time variation in a shape. You have so much natural experimental diversity, and then you can tinker with them live because they create lots and lots of embryos. So they're a great model system, I think, for how do genes work together to create cool evolutionary shapes and stuff. So I was working on a set of genes that pattern the hand, that set up the axis between the thumb and the pinky. And there's a little protein that sort of sets up a gradient. And I was trying to figure out how that would change the shape of the shell. So the idea is that you could, with a snail, you could kind of get all those dials of really getting precise about how genes tweak to make the shape change, which I think would be great for creating horrific eldritch monsters, should we need them, all sorts of natural opportunities, of course.
So I believe the answer is, after Darcy used the cocaine, she told you about snail shell chirality. And thus we learned several lessons from one question. Does anyone have another question? A follow-up.
To that question.
To the snail one?
No, to the cocaine question.
Who pays you to do that?
The question is, who pays you to give snails cocaine? Well, until Marco Rubio took over, the gummit did it, I'll bet.
Thank you.
Exactly. Yeah, I had a grant.
It was from the Colombian government, weirdly enough. Ministry of Trade. Do we have another question? Possibly not about snail cocaine. Yes. The question is, what is a book or product that we have worked on that is maybe no longer in print that we would love to see available in print again? Darcy, do you have one that not got away, but was allowed to fade into the West?
It's such a good question. I think a lot of my projects are were kind of small indie ones that were never very in print to begin with. there was a space dating show RPG game that was transhumanist, just beautiful nonsense that I wrote for. That was a lot of fun. I'll have to look up the title. I was a small contributor to that one, but that was a pretty fun, bizarre one.
That's magnificent. Mm-hmm. My answer is actually a product that never made it into print.
Mm.
When we had the license for Star Trek, we did a Mirror Universe supplement that was playing inside the Mirror Universe. You were the bad guys. Your job was to knife your way ahead and wind up commanding your own starship. And we loved that product. We put our hearts and souls into it. We made up awful things about beloved Star Trek characters and institutions. We had a blast. But we had the product written, and then Last Unicorn was bought by Wizards of the Coast, and as a consequence of that, they lost the Star Trek license. And we're like, oh man, that's the worst. That great book, Through a Mirror Darkly, we'll never get to do it. And then we got hired by Decipher, and they said, we have the Star Trek license. And we're like, great. Once we get through the initial core books and then maybe the first year of releases, back in we go with this book. We have the rights to it. They never published it. We can just take the month off and release this book. Well, it turns out that one of the higher-ups at Decipher's, I think it was his brother-in-law, maybe his brother, was embezzling. Took all the money Decipher had made from Star Wars cards and even the money that they made from our little Star Trek game, and I guess they went and studied snails with it, is my theory. Yeah, who could say? But anyway, there was no money, and they said, oh, you can't release books that aggressively. We would have to print them and pay a printer and things like that. And so that second version of that book hung fire for forever. And we dedicated it to the Dutch nobleman who invented the goatee. It was so good. So many great things in that book. But that's my white whale, my space amoeba, my one that got away for that one.
And the name of my little zine was Singularity, a transhumanist dating show RPG. Yep, Josh Jordan.
Can't ask any better than that. Okay, thank you so much for coming out. Please continue to listen to the show. Enjoy. Those of you who are Patreon supporters, we love you. Please consider continuing your Patreon support so that we will show up next year. And stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors. Atlas Games, Pelgrain Press, Flagbearer Games, Arc Dream, Dark Tower, and Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/CanonRobin.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Canon Robin merch at tpublic.com/user/CanRobin.
Share a nature fact with the rhinorific latest design, unicorn with a better armor class.
On X, I'm Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, I'm Darcy L. Ross.
.bisky.social. See you next time when Robin and I will once again talk about stuff.